Joyce Chediak, a Lebanese American who has written extensively on the Middle East for Workers World newspaper.
The ruling class writes history from its own perspective, and it leaves out the voice of those oppressed unless they're forced to put that voice in. Now, movies nowadays can be considered history. There's the docudrama, the things are rewritten, and they're put in the movies, and they're presented as history. So let's consider it as history, because it's, I think it's the way that a lot of people get their history. For those of us who are older, our generation, many people think that John Wayne fought at the Alamo. And more recently, I think people think that Brad Pitt and Orlando Bloom were at Troy. In other words, they think that that's the version of events, that the way they really happened. So I think it's important to look at Spielberg from that perspective. He's done a bunch of historical movies. He's very, very talented, and he has huge resources available and very creative. But in my view, his historical movies are from the point of view of the class in power and seek to reform the system. How many people saw Amistad? Okay, good. It's a great idea. It's a wonderful, wonderful uprising of slaves aboard a ship who captured the ship, except for two who they forced to steer the ship to some kind of a port. But the rebellion is the first 5 minutes of the movie. And the rest of the movie is about a legal battle in New England where some kind of good guys in the ruling circles find a loophole that the slaves are stolen property, wrongfully stolen property. And on the basis of that, get freedom. And the whole movie is these talking heads back and forth about the legal issues. How many people saw Schindler's List? It's a very powerful movie. I thought every frame was a work of art in that movie, done in black and white. It was very, very beautiful. Now, why did he choose to do a movie about a Nazi if you're going to talk about the Holocaust? He could have done a movie on the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Imagine if he had brought all that talent to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. He could have done one on Treblinka, an uprising within a camp. So many of the liberated camps, the inmates demanded of the liberators, give us the weapons, give us the weapons. And the Soviets did it. Can you imagine? The Americans wouldn't do it, but the Soviets did it when they liberated the camps. Can you imagine a movie about that? Extracting justice and what they look like. There's a movie about that. I forget who did it. It's a Soviet movie. But Schindler didn't. I mean, not Schindler. Spielberg certainly didn't do it. So Schindler's List is about a Nazi who made a lot of money exploiting cheap Polish Jewish labor, and at the 11th hour, to save his butt, suddenly became a supporter of Jewish people and saved 1,000 people who worked for him from the camps. And they were very grateful. But to me, that's what it's about. And it ends with a big play for Israel. Very moving, very well done. And then this Munich. Now, Munich is maybe more of a docudrama in some ways than the others. Or maybe I just feel that way because I was alive and political at the time. I don't know. It's based on real events. The Palestinians did seize take hostage the Israeli Olympic team at the Munich Olympics. The whole hostage team was killed. And there was a Mossad squad of hit people who went through Europe afterwards and killed Palestinians in Europe. And that's essentially what the movie is about. The assassinations was based on a book called Vengeance by George Jonas about this Mossad team. That's all true. But it's been reinterpreted. The Olympics, the incidents at the Olympics, which I'm going to talk about a little later, what really happened at the Olympics, is kind of treated as a foil, I think. What could be more heinous than the killing of innocent athletes? You know, that seems like the most heinous thing. and to demand revenge or justice or whatever you want to call it. And this team goes throughout Europe and kills Palestinians and does it with precision, not like the Arabs, you know, and that's kind of made clear in the movie. But the violence itself is just so corrupting, you know, that they become like the Palestinians. It's all equal. It's an endless cycle of violence, and one is equal to the other. That's the way I saw the movie. Very well done. The kind of gradual disintegration of the assassination team, their demoralization, their bickering among themselves. They actually become the target of assassinations themselves. They don't know who it is, whether it's the Palestinians, whether it's Mossad, whether it's the KGB. They don't know. That's kind of the lesson of the movie. And in that way, it's critical of Israel. Kind of. There's differences of opinions. But not one of the assassinations stops. They have their criticisms. I would call it Zionist angst. Once people start attacking them, they fight among themselves, and these criticisms come forward. Well, what we did to create Israel wasn't very pretty, but we had to do it. I don't like this any more than you do. But Jews don't do this. They don't act like this. That's the other side of it. How can we call ourselves Jews and do this? I would, you know, kind of think you could say that, how do we call ourselves Americans and do what's going in Iraq? It's an analogy to what the U.S. is doing in Iraq. That's very much in there. So all this comes out. I don't know if I agree with what we're doing, but no one stops doing it. No one stops assassinating Palestinians, even though it's pretty clear that they're killing intellectuals, they're killing diplomats, and probably didn't have anything to do with Munich. And some of the people they target by themselves clearly didn't have anything to do with Munich. So that's what the movie is about to me. Golda Meir, who was prime minister at the time, says, "We are civilized, not like the people who did whatever they did at Munich. We don't act that way." And I think Spielberg kind of cuts that down and says, well, it's all the same. And it focuses on one assassin in particular who starts having dreams about Munich, and then he sees himself as one of the hostage takers. So it's all the same. It's all the same. So what does this mean? To me, it's putting an equal sign between the oppressed and the oppressor. It's all the same. And that's why it's so problematic. Because there is no equal sign between the defensive violence of the oppressed and the aggressive violence of the oppressor. One has nothing to do with the other. Okay, I want to go back to the day. I want to go back to 1972. And talk about what was really going on from our class perspective. 1972 was 5 years after the 1967 war, where Israel, in a preemptive strike, armed to the teeth by the U.S., seized the West Bank from Jordan, the Gaza Strip from Egypt, and the Golan Heights from Syria. We didn't hear much about the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights from Syria. People were bombed with napalm. Palestinians walked into Lebanon for the second time, first in 1948 and then again in 1967. The conditions were terrible. 5 years of living in camps, 5 years of not having enough to eat, 5 years of having nothing. And it was out of the media. Nobody knew about it. Nobody knew about the suffering. And there was a tremendous desperation in the Arab world, and particularly the Palestinians, in 1972. Now, Israel was regularly bombing Lebanon and Syria that year, just like they did in the 70s, preemptive strikes, you know, they just go in and bombard villages or camps. Nobody knew. It was not in the media, maybe in the back pages, maybe not at all. The suffering was terrible. Israel was, the state was headed by Golda Meir, an American. a school teacher from Milwaukee, Golda Meir. Now, she could go to Israel under the right of return, where any Jewish person was automatically a citizen and could go to Israel. But the Palestinians who lived there could not return. I think Golda Meir's most famous statement, at least from the class point of view, was, there are no such thing as Palestinians. Palestinians did not have their identity in 1972. They did not. Their national identity was still stolen from them since 1948. They were called the refugees, the poor refugees in the camps. They were called Arabs. And Golda Meir said, they're Arabs, let the other Arabs take them in, they're all the same. That was the line. So that was the state of the Palestinian strugglers. They were struggling to keep their identity and regain their identity. They were struggling for recognition of their plight. They've come a long way, haven't they? Now, Israel was a pariah state internationally. It had relations with the U.S. and with South Africa. That was it. It was totally propped up by the U.S. It still is, but at least there's some kind of cover. There's more diplomatic recognition. There was no diplomatic recognition at the time. But the state of Israel was very popular here in the U.S. And the way it was viewed is that Israel was the little David with the slingshot in the Middle East fighting the giant Goliath, which was the Arab countries. And everyone was on the side of little David. Now, Germany got the Olympics that year. It was the first Olympics they had since 1932. It was important. Since the Olympics that Hitler presided over. It was an important development for them. And Israel was very anxious for trade, for recognition, for contact with Europe. They put together their strongest Olympic team. Maybe the first, I don't know, I'd have to look it up. But certainly a strong Olympic team for Israel. You know, a country of less than 3 million at the time. It was 11 athletes. But the goal was trade. The goal was contact. The goal was breaking out of isolation. What happened at Munich? Pressure largely from the youth in Lebanon who were so desperate and had such terrible lives at the time in the camps. A very courageous action was mounted by the Palestinian resistance, where in the name of two mainly Christian villages in Lebanon that had been bombed, they seized the Israeli hostages and the Israeli athletes, and they held them hostage. And they were demanding release of 200 Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners. And the whole world was watched on TV. And that was important. That was important. And it was done, it was very creative. Can you imagine, you know, particularly the conditions of the Palestinians at the time, going to Olympic Village in Europe and doing that. It took a lot of guts, it took a lot of planning, it took a lot of consideration. It was never a suicide action. There weren't very many at all at that time. That was not the way the struggle went. Now, the popular myth is that the Israelis had a team there and the West German police had a team there and they were trying to negotiate. They were caught. I mean, they could negotiate the release of the hostages. And it looked like it was going well. And then at the last minute, the Palestinians took a grenade and threw it into the helicopter that was taking off the athletes. And they massacred them all. And that was the myth. And it's still the myth that I've seen it, you know, last week when I was doing research about what happened in Munich. But it has nothing to do with what happened in Munich. Reuters, September 9th, did an interview, a partial interview with Mohammed Daoud, who organized what happened in Munich from the Palestinian perspective. He managed to escape assassination. And he said that if the West German police and the Israelis were responsible for the death of the Israeli athletes, and I think two Palestinians were killed at that time. And BBC also said at the time, the West German police opened fire, according to eyewitnesses. And that's what started the whole thing. Now, Moshe Dayan, who was the general in charge, the Israeli general in charge of the 1967 war, was working with the West German police as a consultant. The Israelis had a SWAT team, but the West German police wouldn't let them in. But the Israeli view, very strong and very strongly stated, was that this must not succeed, whatever the costs. We are willing to sacrifice our people. This hostage-taking attempt must never succeed. And they were working hand in glove with the West German government. You know, the Nazis were never fully purged from the bourgeoisie or the government in West Germany. So here's the contradiction, you know, of Israel working hand in glove with them against the Arabs. There was never any criticism on the part of Israel of what the West Germans did. You know, never. The Palestinians have always been blamed for this. Also, the negotiator with the Palestinian team, Zayed Kassa, said, quote, the Germans were going to take them out no matter what. He was the negotiator at the time. This statement was made pretty recently. And what was happening here in 1972? There was a big anti-war movement. The Vietnam War was on. There was no focus at all on what was happening in the Middle East. It was a single-issue struggle. The United for Peace and Justice forces, their predecessors, were the ones who had the upper hand in the movement. But also the SWP and the CP were also very strong, and none of them supported the Palestinian struggle. Palestinians were doing other things too. They were hijacking airplanes. There was quite a bit of airplane hijacking. Anything to call attention to the daily murders and people dying of starvation and people dying from the environment, you know, the elements. Anything to call attention to that. And both the CP and the SWP criticized their tactics. You know, says you're just creating a situation. You're just giving the Israelis more ammunition. No, that's not the way you struggle. We were the only ones who gave unconditional support to the Palestinian struggle from a working class point of view. And it was hard. You know, in 1967, we lost half the subscription of our newspaper when we came out against Israel. And there was no clarity on the question at the time. And the next 5 years were not much easier. We put out a leaflet, which is on your seats, right after the Munich incidents, what every worker should know about the violence in the Olympics. It's a long leaflet. People read more then, you know. Now it's all TV. It's got everything in it, though. It's got the whole line in it. And I'm going to quote from it a little bit. The West German government got its orders from the Israelis, specifically from Moshe Dayan, who had flown to Munich, and Israeli representatives at the scene of the bloodshed. Accordingly, the West Germans flew the Palestinians and their Israeli hostage to an airport on a NATO base. As sure a death trap for both Jewish athletes and the Arabs is a bed of quicksand. West German police and military forces had surrounded the area before the helicopters carrying the Palestinians and Israelis even landed. Almost immediately, the police fired directly into the vehicles containing both Arabs and Jews, and in the end, 15 people had been killed. The Israeli state, with the help of the West Germans, had ruthlessly sacrificed their athletes as expendable Jewish blood, so they could have an excuse to bomb Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon and Syria, murdering scores of Palestinians and spokesmen in Tel Aviv, after being assured of continued American support, indicating that this was just the beginning. Now, right after what happened in Munich, let me stick to one topic. And we passed out this leaflet everywhere that we were. Here, we had as many as 5 people on defense supporting the one person passing out the leaflet. It was very difficult. But it was something that we took on willingly and gladly because of the importance of the issue, the strategic importance of the U.S. Interests there both in regard to oil and as a wedge against the Soviet Union in the time. We felt it was an issue where there could be no compromise. And it was also taking this issue on and taking the Palestinian issue on at the time strengthened our party. It helped us become a fighting organization because we had to fight to defend our line. We also brought the Middle East and Palestinian struggle up in the anti-war movement. We carried signs and banners, no Vietnam War against the Arab people. And we had to defend those physically, too, in the various demonstrations. We had many demonstrations on the Middle East. When Israeli officials came here, particularly Golda Meir, but with whoever was prime minister or whoever was the economic representative, we would have a demonstration. We had them everywhere they were, all over the country. And we had to defend these, too. And we did. Now, after Munich, the day after, the Israelis bombed camps in and villages in Lebanon and Syria, killing between 200 and 500 people. They say that the movie and the kind of popular myth that's arisen around these, that's kind of being picked up by the press as they discuss Munich, this is not really mentioned. Also, they say that, well, this is why Israel began targeting Palestinian leaders with assassinations. But that had been going on before, and it continued long after. And I don't know if people remember Hassan Kanafani. I know the old-timers do. He was a poet and an intellectual who was killed much earlier than Munich in 1972. When I met the Palestinian leadership in 1980 in Lisbon, when they had a first conference in solidarity with the Palestinian people in Europe, the ones in Beirut talked about what their lives were like, that they hadn't seen their family in many years, that they had to live in constant vigilance. And Arafat himself never slept in one place very long for his entire career, up to the very end, because there was always the threat of assassination. The sensibilities of the movement Munich are current sensibilities, put on what happened, kind of as a cookie cutter, what happened in Munich. Because there were no regrets by the assassins, at least in this book called Vengeance. It was a different time. The regrets come after the struggle. They come after there's some opposition. This is what creates division in the ruling class. Opposition, struggle of the oppressed. So the mental framework that Spielberg deals with is a current one. It's the one of a strong Palestinian movement, which has created many questions, and the questions and wouldn't come out at all if the struggle wasn't there. Now, and I just want to emphasize again that this is the same mentality right now in the U.S. on Iraq. The questions that come out, the divisions that come out, not because anybody's doing anyone a favor, not because anyone's trying to be nice, but it's the struggle itself that generate them. You know, one of the Israelis says, I don't care about, that when they make a mistake and kill some of the, quote, wrong people, I don't care about any blood but Israeli blood, you know. Well, don't we hear that? We just care about American blood in Iraq, you know, or some kind of variation on that. And the other way is Americans don't do this. We don't act this way. Or this isn't pretty, but we have to do it. That's the big one, right? That wouldn't even come out. It would just be waving the flag in glory. And remember how it was in the beginning where we were doing, we're doing the Iraqis a big favor by going in, you know? That only changed with the struggle. And the whole view of Israel was the same way. Everything was perfect until the struggle. And that's essentially what I want to say, because even though it's not in the movies, or even though it's not talked about, it's the struggle that determines everything. And the Palestinians have struggled under the hardest of circumstances. No rear base, very little support internationally, yet they've come such a long way. They have reclaimed their identity. They have shown the world who they are and that they have rights and are entitled to self-determination and are entitled to a state. and entitled to return and everything else that a people is entitled to. And they're really an inspiration. Well, the Palestinians have never really been isolated in the Middle East. It's always been called the Central Arab Cause, the cause of Palestine. It's been felt by every Arab since 1948 on. And I think it still lives in the hearts of Arab people and others in the Middle East. But the Arabs have been very oppressed, very impoverished, locked in other centuries by imperialism. And it's been very hard to struggle. And there's been Arab bourgeoisie, which wants to give lip service to struggling, but doesn't want to struggle. And that's always been the case, too. So it's a national struggle and it's a class struggle. And in order for the Arab workers and peasants to give solidarity for the Palestinians, they've had to fight their own bourgeoisie to do that. And their own bourgeoisie, since the 70s on down, has become more and more captive of the U.S., where the U.S. is forced them to spend oil money on weaponry. Most of it is offensive, but and not that usable. But a good portion of it also is to build up their own internal police force or forces against their own masses. There's always been solidarity between Iraq and Palestine. During the first Gulf War, the Palestinians were in solidarity with Iraq, suffered greatly for it. Arafat and what was the beginnings of the Palestinian Authority supported the Iraqis. And it's vice versa. It's together. As far as actual relations between the two and how they work, I don't know right now. It's a difficult time. I can't say. But ideologically, it's all seen as one struggle. It's seen as the Arab people essentially, there are differences in this, and there's a development, see themselves as one nation, the Arab nation. It's carved up by imperialism into different countries, and that still exists. Back to the movie, I don't mean, Spielberg is very good, he's very slick. I don't think he portrayed all the Palestinians as animals. But there were portrayals of Palestinians where they look just like you see people on the street who you know were probably portrayed by Arabs, you know. He probably hired Arabs in the movie. But there was no development of anyone. No development at all of any Palestinian. And most of the Arab dialogue was not translated, with everybody else's dialogue was translated. And you know, movies are a slick vehicle. You know who's the hero, you know who they focus on, who they don't. And by portraying Palestinians kind of the way you see them on the street and not letting you know how you're supposed to react to them, you bring whatever you have to the images that are presented. So I don't think that there was a sympathetic portrayal. Also, some of the Palestinian characters said very good things and very real things, but I think it just kind of all ran together. That's my view. Although other people may bring different things to them, I think that's very, very true of this other movie that's out, Suriana, where most people bring what they already have to that movie. But that's a whole other story. Peace, the whole question of peace. Spielberg wants you to think peace. You think that let's just all stop the violence and have peace. It's very strong, you know? But there can't be class peace without justice. We know this, you know? And the oppressor doesn't arrive at this idea of peace unless the struggle from the oppressed. There has to be a... Sometimes the oppressor, a soldier or whatever, in Vietnam, say, in the early period, they're doing genocidal things and they don't like it. It's awful. They see awful things being done. But it takes a framework of the struggle of the oppressed to create the environment to articulate that even, more than just one person. You know, that's what it takes. So this is a false peace in the movie, although it's very powerful when you feel it. But the way to achieve true peace is through justice. Just quickly, I left out something that was back in the day in 1967. That was the beginning of the U.S. using its veto in the U.N. to protect Israel. And with 32 vetoes from 1972 to 1997, protecting Israel from any censor in the UN. And this one, the resolution was condemning Israel for bombing the camps in Lebanon and Syria. And the U.S. ambassador at the time was George Bush Sr., who was defending his class and his oil interests, and did the first veto. I hope you get a chance to look at that leaflet. I think it's a perfect leaflet. It's long, but I think it's got a whole line in it, and well said. And I think that, you know, one of the things that that's brought up in that leaflet is the question of anti-Semitism, which is important. Because, you know, Spielberg raises some of the problems. Some of the problems come out. But we have a solution. We're against all forms of racism. We're against anti-Semitism. We're for self-determination for the Palestinians. The leaflet points out that Arabs and Jews can live in the Middle East together as equals, in an equal society, in a democratic, secular state. And our party know that that's not going to happen until there's socialism there. And that's we have a solution. That's the real solution to it. And we bring that to the movement.